Okay. So Hank Rogers is a very old friend. I've known him about a year longer than I've known you for, because I met him.
My life.
I met him before you were born. He is very well known in the gaming industry because he's the publisher of Tetris, but he's recently, in the last few years, handed over the running of the Tetris company to Maya, his daughter, and he's been very focused on projects like global warming, which he's been endlessly canvassing about. He started a thing called the Blue Planet Alliance, and on the side, he's working on a moon base project. So he's moved away from doing the games, or at least changed the scale of them.
That is such a ludicrous sentence, isn't it? He's now working on a movie. But it fits him very well. Like, obviously, we were talking about it before. I've known him my whole life. And, I'm English. I grew up in England. And Hank was this sort of very strange and exotic big personality who'd kind of waft in a linen suit and a fedora or a fez sometimes. And he was like one of those people that I always knew, like, something big and exciting is going to be going on around here, and he's going to either get dad in some really exciting project or in a lot of trouble or both.
Yeah. Well, it's true. There was a lot of exciting projects.
And a lot of trouble, wasn't there?
Was both, yeah. But it was a lot of fun. And I think now his focus is very much on getting the world fixed. So he is very focused on the future, very focused on the notion, not just of zero emissions by 2045, but actually quicker if possible, and reducing the carbon in the atmosphere, ultimately building a sort of global th thermostat. What we have now, we have the technology to do that. We just need the political will. And that's what Hank has treated as one of his main challenges in life, getting that focus on the political will to get these things sorted. And Blue Planet Alliance is one of the engines he's chosen to do this.
And I think for anyone who's ever met Hank, they'll know if someone's gonna do this, it'll be him. He's sort of, it's, I feel like it's almost impossible not to get kind of sucked into his sort of positive, active, enthusiastic aura of getting stuff done. I think that's why, like, listening to this one, it's sort of like listen, the Mark Stevenson one. Both of them are people who have really big battles to fight, but are totally undaunted because they know what they're doing. They know it's going to be good in the end, and they've just got a really joyful, positive attitude to getting the job done. Which I think, and Mark actually said it before, I think that's the thing is, when you're moving people around, when you're trying to change minds and get people on side, who's having the most fun is a really compelling way of getting people on your side. And I think they're both really great people for making doing the right thing look like a lot of fun.
Yes, which I think ultimately it will be. I don't think saving the planet is a horrific job. It's a huge job, but it could be a brilliant job. It's something we all need to focus on. And it's not just about doing the modest things that make everyday life a little bit better. It's also focusing on and campaigning for our politicians to get it. This is what we want. We want a world fit for our children and our grandchildren. And you better be paying attention.
And actually, what they're both very good at as well is not letting anyone get away with anything.
Yeah.
anyone's doing anything that seems sort of hypocritical or lackadaisical or like they're immovable, they're very quick to be like, no, I'm not having this. There's no good reason we don't do this. Get on board.
Yes. Oh, that's true. That's true. He has a great positive energy about him. Anyway, you can see for yourselves, because we talked for quite a long time. We might even split this into two talks, because it was such a long talk. And it wasn't even finished at the end of it. So, but now, Hank Rogers, publisher of Tetris, saver of the planet, if he can. Yes.
If I still have those up, I put them up somewhere. Yeah, I'm great.
I think maybe this time we'll introduce the Blue Planet. What is it called? Blue Planet
Alliance,
and that governmental body you went to see before, because we never really had any clear idea what they were.
Oh, you're talking about SIDS, the Small Island Developing States?
No. It's a kind of international government that you were asked.
Yeah, International Parliamentary Union.
Yes. Yes. Now, we met at a hotel just after you got back from that a couple of years ago when you were talking about global warming.
When we met, I was coming back from COP26 or COP25. It's the yearly event where they try to, it's the Paris Agreement and the Kyoto Agreement. Those are all COPs.
Right.
I think Paris Agreement is like COP22 or something like that. And the next one's in Glasgow in November.
And what does COP stand for?
It's the Conference of Parties. That's what it stands for. It means nothing, actually. But it's United Nations. The United Nations, all the countries get together and try to figure out how to solve global warming.
Right.
So that's COP24.
So what was the thing that where you talked about global warming to a parliamentary group?
Yeah, so that was the IPU. That's in Geneva, but I don't think I came to see you after that. I was in Geneva and I gave a speech.
Yes, you did come. You stayed at the hotel in Lewis because you told me all about your speech.
Okay. I'm confusing it with the time when I stayed in. Yes, got it.
You're doing too much.
Yes, I am. No, but yes, absolutely. So that's the Interparliamentary Union. So each country gets to send two parliamentarians, meaning elected officials. They have to be elected. And they get to have a sum total of 7 minutes between them to speak to the assembly. So it's just a nonstop people ranting and raving about whatever their pet peeve is, wherever. And they gave me 15 minutes.
Right. To talk about global warming.
I was their guest speaker. And so, yes, I did. I did talk about climate change and so on. And they declared climate change to be the emergency that assembly, which made me feel like Superman.
Well, good. Good.
Yeah. I mean, when I finished and they had, you know, like I didn't know what I was getting into. I kind of showed up an hour early to find out what actually goes on at the IPU. And so I got to hear all these countries ranting and raving. You know, Angola said that even though they're the fourth most commonly spoken language in the world, they didn't have simultaneous translation, but the Japanese did. it was like amazing. And then at the one in Dubai, which I went to later, there was the elected contingent from Venezuela, but then there was also Maduro representatives saying they're not legitimate. And there was like that whole tension going on in there between the Maduro guys and the guys who were elected who were like disqualified, whatever.
Yeah.
So, and then there was the Iranian woman, and she was in my group. She was in my group where we were actually working on the words. And she was all, I mean, her face wasn't covered, but I mean, she was wearing the burqa. And she had a translator there who was a guy. And at a certain point, you know, she was saying something, he was translating, and she was saying something, translating. And then all of a sudden, like some question, something came up, and he didn't even ask her. He just answered. And then the woman who was in charge of this meeting said, you, sir, are not to answer for her. She is the representative. And actually, they knew that she spoke English. So she didn't need a fucking translator. And so it was like, yes, they had a woman to represent them, but they were fucking controlling her every step of the way. But the thing that got me at the end of all of that is that, I was in that room, like going thing after thing, saying, you should do this, you shouldn't do this. And I was their freaking expert on climate change in the room. And I helped them, you know, I changed, what was it? We must maintain leadership in fighting climate change. And I raised my hand as Mr. Rogers. I said, you know, before I came to Geneva this time, I never even knew who the hell you guys were, the International Parliamentary Union. I'm in the business of fighting climate change. You know, that's what I do. And if you're going to maintain leadership in something, first you have to take leadership. they changed the words to "we must take leadership in fighting climate change." Again, I felt like Superman. That was the next day. They asked me in to help them, you know, fix the draft resolution and you know, get through the word. And then we did a crawl through this document which they were going to release. And one of the things was this section from the IPCC. And it said like 1.5 degrees, and it was a paragraph that they had like just plopped in there from the IPCC saying that we must stay within 1.5 degrees, 1.5 degrees, 1.5. And it was like said 1.5 degrees like four or five times. And somebody said, yeah, it says 1.5 degrees too many times. Why don't we, you know, shorten it? And I raised my hand, Mr. Rogers. I said, you guys are politicians. Those guys are scientists. They have a reason for every word that they put in their language. It's not your job to change the language that they use. This is the problem in my country. You know, our government takes the words of the scientists and says, you can't use the word global warming. So you cannot change the words of the scientists. They have to come through absolutely clear. So you shouldn't touch those words. And they didn't. So it was just like, it was good. And that Iranian guy who was supposed to be like guarding the woman, he came over after, he came over to me and he had tears in his eyes and he said, thank you. So go figure. So, you know, like however you want to look at the Iranians as being evil and so on and so forth, they have children too. And they have to have a future that their children can live in. So, I mean, the politics of what was going on there was weird, but still, you know, they have to have this same outcome.
Well, that's the beauty of this, isn't it? It's for everybody's benefit. There is no organism on this earth that isn't going to benefit from this.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely.
Tell me about, I love all your stories about that. I particularly love the stories you told me about when the Chinese delegation said, we don't understand the science of this. We don't know how to do it. Can you remember that story?
Barely. I mean, yeah, I was trying to get
you told them they don't have to. You've got scientists who do. You just have to tell them we're going to do this.
Yeah. Yeah, no, this is the thing that I say to the politician, and is you just have to understand that there is a problem and that needs to be solved. You don't need to know how to solve the problem. You just need to have give order and say, you're the goddamn leaders of your country. You tell your scientists, your business people, everybody that this needs to be solved and get on with it. It's not like you don't want to hear any reasons why it can't be done or why it shouldn't be done from your fucking economists. This has to be done.
Yeah.
And you just need to get through to the people and say, you know what, we're going to do this. I'm going to make a documentary about how we did what we did in Hawaii.
Yeah, because last time I was with you on the ranch, you were still having the oil company that ran the electrical, the utilities, refusing to allow people to put power back into the grid.
It's the electric company, and they still are. These things are all changing. These things are all changing. The grid is just not capable of handling, you know, variable electricity. It's not big enough. Germany can bleed into, I mean, it's big enough so that they can accept the variability of solar and still survive. But the Hawaii, each island is its own grid. And so they can't have it put too much electricity onto the grid at any given moment. That's the explanation. And I kind of sort of believe them. It must be a nightmare for them, you know, when all of a sudden it gets cloudy, it must drop the amount of electricity that comes off the solar. And then when all of a sudden it clears up, it must go up, you know, that kind of thing. So, yeah, but we had, you know, right now the situation is that they're going to make more money the quicker they switch to renewables. And that is put them clearly on our side.
Right.
Because now they're shareholders here. Oh, we can find a way to make more money. Yeah, that's a good thing.
Let's follow up from your ranch, because you've got batteries there. So you reckon, I think you gave me figures that you could run the ranch for a month on one sunny day's collection of solar energy.
No, because we size the solar array so that it basically collects enough solar so that it works on a cloudy day.
Yeah. But what I meant is you produce more electricity than you need.
Yes.
So you've got a whole array of batteries. I remember them. And then you have an electrolysis machine where you're breaking down the air into its constituent parts.
Water.
And storing hydrogen.
Yes. And this in about, 3 hours, we have a big meeting at the ranch and virtual with the powers that be in Hawaii about building a hydrogen infrastructure on the Big Island.
Right.
We're talking about building 5 fueling stations. We're talking about building a big electrolyzer by a hydroelectric dam that exists somewhere that is not being used. This is what we're doing.
It seems to me, from what I've read, that it's potentially a lot more environmentally friendly to have hydrogen-fueled cars than electrical cars. But there is a need for a hydrogen infrastructure to do that. At the moment, there isn't even an electrical infrastructure for everyone to switch to electrical cars.
Yeah.
But hydrogen being the better option, people were saying they need it to be a domestic gas. They need to reinvent gas cookers, things like that, so you can cook with hydrogen.
Yes.
Now, it means a new set of recipe books, because hydrogen cookers.
Yes, I had this conversation. Did we have this conversation?
Yeah, we did.
Hydrogen cookbook.
But we're recording it now.
All right. Got it. Are we recording something? Are you recording?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, good.
So we'll edit out all your bad language.
All right.
No, we won't.
I'm watching a TV show. It's actually brilliant. It's about the main character is an ex-president. He was like president 25 years ago, something like that. And he is finally looked himself up on the internet and found out that he was the biggest asshole president ever. And like pretty much everything he did was cut funding for, you know, cancer research or put in place anti-refugee immigration laws, or, I mean, thing after thing, you know, build a highway through a fucking Indian reservation, you know, da, 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 da. He did all these things. He was such a major asshole. And he finally comes to the realization. And now he's trying to change everything back. The things that he's trying to undo what he did. And he has an assistant who was like his biggest fan all his life for what he was before, the big asshole. And so this assistant has this image of him being this fucking asshole that he used to be. And he's looking up to that. And the president is now like totally going in a different direction. And there's this friction going on. And then his wife is running for the Senate. So she needs him to be straight. And he's off the reservation every single episode. He's going off of the reservation in some direction. He says, oh, anybody who's got deportation notices, come to my ranch in New Mexico. And so he gets thousands of people with deportation order. And he says, I dare the government to come and take you away. And then he does shit like that. And it's like a constant thing. It's, I don't know. I mean, I didn't have any expectations. I just accidentally select things to watch while I'm falling asleep. And I watched this and I made Lisa watch it. We're both watching. We're both hooked on it now. But the point is that a straight up conservative can, you know, it's a show about a conservative asshole becoming conscious. And I don't know, this is kind of what this country needs at this point is, oh, okay. So I was in another meeting a couple of days ago. This should be of interest. And this is a meeting of, it was called donors, something donors, donor. Anyway, their concept is there's $40 billion put into politics every year, something like that. They want 5% of that money. And they want that 5% of that money to go to crossover candidates, meaning candidates that are Republican and Democrats who are willing to work together to fight climate change. Because they found out of all of the issues that exist in this country, the least polarizing, the one that brings everybody together is fighting climate change. Everything right. else has some kind of a political agenda where it's, no, you guys are assholes, blah, 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 blah. Climate change is a common ground. And so their concept is if they have 5% of the money and can control 5% of the votes, that is swing votes in pretty much every jurisdiction in this country. And they can swing elections. Then they can start moving in the right direction vis-a-vis climate change and reunifying this country. That's the idea. And then I talked to somebody else yesterday. There is a congressional group, and they have a name, and I forget what the name is, but they're bipartisan. Again, it's a group of Democrats and Republicans that are actually working together. And they created the legislation that was the last bailout, the last, $600 billion, the last money that went to people. That came from them. It was a bipartisan effort.
Right.
And so these guys are doing bipartisan legislation. And so bringing both people from both parties. So there is some ray of hope going on right now. That's the way I look at it.
Well, it seems to me that a future where things like climate change have been sorted and, you know, pollution, all those big issues that make the world a mess could be sorted is actually attainable with technology we have now.
Yeah, absolutely.
You just got to motivate people into applying it.
Well, that's kind of what I'm doing with the app that I want to build.
With the what you want to build?
An app. It's an application. It's
right. You know, I know what an app is. Sorry. But is that to do with the Blue Planet Alliance?
Yes.
So tell us about the Blue Planet Alliance first, because you've just made an announcement.
Right. So the Blue Planet Alliance is an organization. I set up shop in New York, 777 UN Plaza. So I'm probably moving to New York. It's just a desk right now. I mean, we're starting small. It's just an address. But it gives me access to all of the NGOs that are working with the United Nations, first of all, that are in that building. And there's probably more than 100 in that building.
Right.
And it also gives me access to the United Nations. It means I get to attend UN events. I get to meet ambassadors, all that kind of stuff. I get to go to COP and be in the room. So that's the top-down approach. And what we're doing with the top-down approach is we are starting with the small island developing states, the SIDS countries. There are 57 of them. We've got an MOU, a memorandum of understanding in the works with them to help them establish mandates. Mandate of 100% by 2045 or 2040 or 20, whatever it is, a mandate. And basically we want it to be the Hawaii model. We want them to have a mandate and then figure out how to achieve the mandate. Not make a mandate that's unrealistic and unrealizable, like the one they had in Aruba, which they're failing at right now. There's a Samoa, there's a number of places that have a mandate, that had a mandate for 100% by 2020, and they're just nowhere near those mandates. And the reason is it's unrealistic. They didn't actually ask their utility, how are we going to do this? They basically told their utility, this has got to be done.
But that's what you advised earlier. You said to your politicians, politicians, you tell the scientists.
I know, but the utility will say, you know, if you say, can you go 100% renewable by 2100? The utility says, sure, no problem. There isn't anybody at the utility who's still going to be alive in 2100. So how about 2050? Yeah, we can probably do 2050. 2025, no, that's a problem. I mean, even like not understanding what's going on, they can say that they can agree to a date in the future by which, yes, we can actually achieve this.
But and this is what you want them to say is we could achieve this, but we require this switch in technologies to do it.
I don't want them to say there's no end. I'm just saying what we did in Hawaii, which was 1.5 million people importing $5 billion a year on oil. What we said to them is we want that to end, and we're on track to ending it. And we didn't know how, and they didn't know how we were going to achieve this in the beginning, but now we know. First of all, we changed the incentive by making sure that they make more money when they switch to renewables. That's one. That's the incentive in the right place. And that is the, what was the other thing? Gosh, I'm in the middle of a speech and I lost my train of thought. Basically, we gave them and they came out, and as a result of this, they came up with an RFP, a request for proposal for 800 megawatts of renewable energy last year. That's half of Hawaii. So now people are proposing energy projects to them that's going to total 800 megawatts. They're choosing between these wind and solar and whatever. That's half of Hawaii.
And you're using the heat of the volcanoes in that equation as well, right?
So I recently had another conversation. This is geothermal, and it's something like this. It's ridiculous. There was so much noise around the establishment and the post-establishment of the existing geothermal plant, which is only 36 megawatts. Which is, 15% of the Big Island. 15% of the Big Island. And there was so much native noise that everybody is gun shy. They have this thing called an environmental impact statement. And that's before you do a project, you have to ask the people, is it okay for us to do this project? And then people will come out and say, whatever. And the noise was so loud on the last one that they completely became gun shy. And now, so if you want to do a 30 megawatt geothermal plant, they say the potential for this plant could be that it could be 200 megawatts. So I want you to do an EIS for 200 megawatts. And now the cost of the EIS and the amount of bullshit that you have to go through means it takes like 10 years to get through the EIS, because there are going to be court cases from people who are trying to stop this thing. Geothermal takes up 10% of solar or wind in terms of land footprint.
Hmm.
It doesn't need ag land. It can be anywhere as long as you can drill down to the heat source. So it can be on the shittiest land that you have that's not being used for anything. That's where you build it. And so it's really the answer for Hawaii. And we're just being really stupid about it. What I'd really like to see happen, so Big Island is 200 megawatts of, you know, and 200 megawatts of electricity is needed to power the Big Island. I want to build 2,000 megawatts on the Big Island of geothermal.
Right.
And then use the excess energy to make hydrogen and export hydrogen and made it and make money.
Yes.
Exporting the hydrogen. You can export it to other parts of Hawaii. You could export it to Japan.
Well, there are other countries that could do this. I mean, Iceland is an example that doesn't have the same religious problems about geothermal.
Right.
Because it is what you're talking about. It's essentially a religious problem.
Right. Right. So Iceland, the core, the history of Iceland is they're 300,000 people, not 200. So they're just 50% more than the Big Island of Hawaii. And their problem was something like 200 megawatts, and they built 2 gigawatts of geothermal and hydro. And they had the cheapest, at the end of the day, they had the cheapest electricity in Europe. And so they took that and made the most energy hog industry in Europe, and they took that over, which is the smelting of aluminum.
Right.
They took over the aluminum business. So what the hell? I mean, how can you have an island in the middle of the Atlantic become the biggest producer of aluminum in Europe? Aluminium, sorry.
Whatever. Each works.
And so, I mean, that was vision. Somebody had vision. This is in the 70s.
Right.
You know, so Reykjavik used to burn coal. And if you look at the old pictures, you see this cloud of coal dust floating over Reykjavik. And it was just nasty. And people had all the respiratory illnesses that go along with, you know, like London in the old days. And now it's absolutely clean. There's not a cloud in the sky. They use the hot water from the geothermal directly, by the way. They don't just only make electricity out of it. So from this plant, and I think it's like 20 kilometers, they take and they move hot water to Reykjavik.
Right.
And they have heat exchangers. So they don't exactly use the water that comes out of the ground. They heat up water in Reykjavik. They've got these massive, on the hill above Reykjavik, they have these massive tanks. And they're so huge that there's a restaurant on top of them. You know, that's how big it is. And that hot water gets distributed for heating and hot water throughout Reykjavik. So they have centralized heating and centralized hot water. That's geothermal.
I mean, potentially, and it can't be far away because the technology exists. We could be living in a world where there is pretty much unlimited energy.
Hmm. Yeah, this is the thing that this is the thing that is like crazy about the situation is we get so much solar energy on this planet every single day. And it comes to us in the form of wind and solar, because wind energy is all solar energy. It's hot, it's air being heated up and moving around because of solar. We've got so much energy landing on this planet. It's ridiculous. And we spend, we use fossil fuel to cool our buildings to fight against this energy that's landing on them. It's like, you have got to be fucking kidding me. It's so ridiculous. I mean, that's the situation, yes. that is absolutely situation. And yes, all the technology is here, but there's a lot of inertia behind the existing technologies. We just cut the Keystone pipeline. Yeah.
Tell us about that.
So the Keystone pipeline, and they were fighting against this. The natives were fighting because they were dragging this thing through by native lands and potentially messing up their aquifer if it leaks. And these things leak all the time. This is a pipeline that goes from Canada, from Alberta, where they're planning to use the tar sands of Alberta and squeeze the oil out of the tar sands. It takes as much energy as you get out of the oil to squeeze it out of the tar sand. So you're using half the energy to get it out of the ground, so to speak. And the way tar sand works is you scrape the forest off a large section of land and you expose the tar sands and then you freaking mine them. It's open pit mining for oil.
I had a conversation with a paleontologist about dinosaurs once, and I said, we can only guess at their colors. And she said, not necessarily, because in the Alberta tar pits, they're finding 70 million year old trees with leaves that are still flexible.
Wow.
And I said, does that mean you'll find dinosaurs, you know, with their bodies still intact? And she said, well, you can be sure of one thing. If they did, the oil companies would make sure no one knew about it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So that there's another story that's similar to that. So my father was in the gem business, and part of the gem business was opal coming from Australia.
Yeah.
And the way opal works is, in general, is that you have fossils like shells or skeletons or whatever that get trapped in the mud as they turn into fossils, and the animal itself dissolves and is replaced by opal, among other things. You know, there's other things that also work in there anyway.
Is opal basically calcium, like a pearl?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Sorry, finish your story. I didn't mean to.
So the story is this guy finds a fucking fish like this, opal. I mean, it is an opalized fossil fish. Can you imagine somebody should, you know, want that thing and pay millions of dollars for it? What does he do? He cuts it up so that they can make jewelry. How horrible is that? That is, he's probably found the most precious thing ever, and he just cuts it up like, oh, well, there's opal in there.
Yes.
Ouch. He used to bring me shells, like opalized shells that were part opal and part something else, and I used to polish the opal bits so you'd have a shell that had part, you know, opal. And the rest of it was still the shell, the fossil of the shell.
Yeah.
So the idea was to make fossil jewelry. I thought it was a good idea. I mean, you know, preserve the fossil part of it, and just, yeah, it was carving and carve the, anyway, yeah. So where were we?
Well, tell me more about the Blue Planet Alliance. Who have you got on board? What are you? Where is it now?
Okay, so so I told you about the top-down approach, which is to get countries to have mandates and yes. work with the United Nations. So, but the United Nations has proven to be nice but ineffective. Nobody's on the Paris Agreement. Nobody's within the 2 degrees that we need to save our asses. And the IPCC has since come out and said, you know, 2 degrees isn't enough. We need to stay within 1.5 degrees or we're screwed. And so we're not even on track for 2%, I mean, 2 degrees. So first of all, I think that 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees, this is an ununderstandable goal for ordinary people.
Yeah.
Like, what can I do to stay within 2 degrees? What does it mean to me? It doesn't mean anything to me. Well, 2 degrees could happen naturally. I don't know that. I'm not a scientist. I mean, this is all science gobbledygook talk. And so trying to get politicians to enforce staying within 2 degrees is really hard because you got to do dozens of things. And so I really want them to focus on energy and waste and so on. This is what I want them to focus on. But the problem is United Nations isn't going to get it done. And so I'm thinking, how is it going to get done? Who is going to actually do this? And the answer is the people are going to do this. So instead of the United Nations, we have to work with the United People. And how do we get them to change things? And so what I come from the game world. So the app that I'm creating is like a Yelp. Have you used Yelp before?
No.
Ah, okay. Yelp is, I want to go and have dinner, and you go to Yelp, and then basically you say Italian, and then it lists all the Italian restaurants in your within like walking or driving okay. distance yeah. where you are.
Yeah, it's like we had Yellow Pages, so Yelp is descendant from that, I think. Yes.
Okay, it's much better than that, because then when you click on, they sort the restaurants by rating or anything else you'd like. And then you can find comments, and you can see how many stars restaurants got and all that. And that's how you can make your decision about where you're going to eat. And it tells you whether it's cheap or medium or expensive or like ridiculously expensive. Those are the four categories. Anyway, you get this information. I want to do that for things to do. Because people, whenever I talk, at the end of when I talk to them, they come up to me and say, what can I do? They're motivated. Yes, I want to do something. What can I do? And my answer is always, I'm sorry, but I don't know you. I know what I can do. I can get up on the stage and try to convince you to do something, but what it is that you can do, only you can answer that. You know, you have to figure out what you can and what you will do and do that, whatever it is. And the problem with this is that a lot of people out there just don't have a clue. what can I do, or what should I do?
And I've got an issue with what you're saying, but I'll wait to the end. Get on.
Yeah. So basically, what the app is it coughs up a bunch of things that you can do, and you pick one of those, and then when you do it, then you get points. And then the next time you will do something else and you get more points, and you keep on getting points till you go up a level. And when you go up a level, we give you more interesting things or more difficult things to do. And then to go up a level, each time you to go up a level, you have to do more difficult things. So what we're doing is we're growing you up as an environmentalist. And the things to do, I asked like 100 people, send me 5 things that you need to get, that you think we need to do to fix everything. And I categorized them. And first I came up with 12 categories, and I said, no, that's too many to choose from. So I finally managed to categorize them into 3 categories, and 95% of the to-do fell into those 3 categories. The 3 categories are energy, which has to do with, you know, carbon capture and eliminating, you know, all of that stuff, climate change. Number two is waste, which has to do with like stop throwing things into a landfill, or the circular economy, you know, making sure that we're not throwing anything out. Everything should be a resource for something else. And then the third one is nature, and that's direct intervention, cordoning off areas to be nature preserves. The concept there is to end up where with a planet where 50% is reserved for nature.
At least.
At least.
Yeah.
Okay, so those are the three things, and then there's other, you know, whatever is doesn't fit in those categories. And basically what happens if you click on one of those saying, I want to do something about waste, then it'll give you a bunch of things to do, and it will show you what the most amazing thing somebody did about waste yesterday. So there's a competition to become that, you know, biggest mover of the day. So you can find things that other people did, but then there's a list of things that you can do. And they're very, very simple. Okay. Pick up garbage off the street and put it into the trash bin, or, put your plastics in a recycle bin, or the simple things that we already do. And so you get points for things, doing things that you already do. And then you go up a level in that. And we use AI to figure out what you're most likely to want to or and be able to do. That is the kind of thing that Google and Amazon do all the time. They profile you and figure out what you want to buy. What we want to do is profile you and figure out what you want to do. And where are we going to get the things to do? First of all, we're going to get them from the NGOs like the Sierra Club or World Wildlife Federation, or you know, those kinds of organizations that are trying to fix the planet. They generally ask their constituents to do stuff, but they're only talking to a small fraction of the population, which is their members. I'm a member of the Sierra Club, so I get, can you write your congressman? I get these messages all the time. I've never done this, so they have no way of knowing that sending that message to me has an effect or not. They just keep on, and it's annoying, frankly speaking. You know, it's annoying when somebody asks me to do something that I can't or won't do, and they just ask me over and over. It just becomes nagging. So it's like they're nagging me. What needs to happen is that that message, write your congressman, needs to go out to everybody. And it's specifically to those people who are good at writing letters to their congressperson. That's who they need to reach. And that's how the app will work, because the app will know that you're a writer because you've chosen write something before, and you'll get more of those kinds of things. So one is the NGOs, but the other way is just simply crowdsourcing, meaning some scientist or some person will come up with something. And here's the interesting part. A celebrity like Leonardo DiCaprio will look and find something, and he says, yes, I want that done. And he will say to his fans, can you do this? And then when his fans do it, not only do they get points, but he gets points. And so every football player or football club or musician, or these freaking boy bands in Korea, whatever, they can tell their fans to do something. You know, there's this boy band, it's BST, and they, when Black Lives Matter movement happened after Floyd got shot by the police, they contributed $1 million to the Black Lives Matter movement. That's the boy band. Their fans collectively also put up $1 million for Black Lives Matter. So they managed to not only do it themselves, but move their fans to do it. And so that is what I'm looking for. I'm looking for celebrities. I'm looking for people who get people to do things to compete with each other to see who can get the most done.
I think we ought to talk about this too, because one of the things that's been on my mind a lot is if you could show people a future where things worked, but that is attainable now from existing technologies, not just cutting back on the carbon levels to, you know, zero by 2045, but actually building the global thermostat that will make life on the planet sustainable. The technologies exist.
No, I understand that. I understand that. So, you know, what percentage of the people in the world would actually understand that? That's my question.
Well, you know, the answer is more people will understand it if they are, if it's explained in a way that they get and they engage with.
Right, but I mean, but you've got a tobacco wallah in freaking Delhi. Try to explain to him that there's some global crisis and so on. He's just trying to survive, make a couple of pennies so that he can feed his family. There's lots and lots of people like that around the world.
You don't have to get everyone. You have to get enough.
No, I understand that. I understand that. And so the concept is everybody has a phone.
And what you said before is your guy in Delhi, he's got kids. He wants them to grow into a better world today.
Oh, yeah, there you go. There you go.
Yeah.
You know, I'm depending on this artist friend of mine to come up with a V. I'm still waiting for it. I was talking.
Don't forget, I already gave you the music. Da 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 da.
Da 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 da. Lisa.
Yes.
Da 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 da. Da 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 da. What's that? Da 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 da. Da 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 da. Da 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 da.
Beethoven.
It's Beethoven's Eighth Symphony.
Okay,
but Morse code dot 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 slash dot 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 da is V.
Is it really?
Yes, it's V in Morse code. So we have a sound that goes along with the V. Da 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 is the sound of V. Damn it. Yes, I don't have a way to write that down.
I'll send it to you. I'll send it to you.
Yeah. All right. Yes. We had dinner with a doctor yesterday, and he had already gotten his vaccination. And, you know, at first we did the elbow thing. And then, like, after we got friendly, he said, you know, and we're leaving, and said, you know what? I'm vaccinated. So he hugged me and he said, you can't give it to me and I can't give it to you. Because I'm vaccinated.
Nearly true, but not necessarily.
Nearly true. But I mean, it's like, okay, so this is the way I look at it. So you've got a room full of mosquitoes and you found like a DDT and you spray the room and you go into the room. That's got to be different from being in a room that hasn't been sprayed at all.
Yes.
You know, like if the virus is killed as quickly as it's produced in your body by your antibodies, there cannot be that many. And it's not zero. It's not zero. Of course it's not zero, but it's a damn sight different from being close to somebody that's actually actively producing millions of them.
That's what they're saying. They're saying that it won't prevent you getting it, but if you get it, you'll only get a mild version.
Yeah, and so what a mild version means is that your ability to project this virus is also going to be mild.
It will protect you from getting it by 80%, 85% more than it would have been without it. That's an approximation.
Yeah, it's 95% effective, 94% actually.
Okay.
The Moderna and the Pfizer. They're 94-95%. And now that they're putting millions of vaccines out there, they're getting way more data. You know, it's no longer test phase, it's out there in the real world. And now we get to find out what percentage people actually, you know, get it. It's more accurate now because you have millions of people taking it.
I don't know how many people have taken it here, maybe coming up to 8 million?
Mm. Yeah, we're getting ours on February 9th.
Okay.
Yeah. So we are going to go to Aspen and snowboard and ski for a week and come back, and then we will get our shots.
I remember being in Aspen with you once. Can you remember?
Were you in Aspen with me? Oh, my goodness. What did we do? Was it with Keiko?
Yes.
What was the deal?
We were staying with some people in Aspen. You stayed in a hotel, but we spent a lot of time together there.
Mm. What were we trying to do?
Well, we went to the... what's it called? The Rocky Mountain Institute?
Oh, RMI. We actually visited Amory Lovins' house. You were there? No.
No, we went to the, you know, their office that's in that.
Okay, the building, yeah. The modern building.
Yeah. Wow. And we saw somebody, God, my memory is rubbish, a very nice guy who built a house that part of it had a tunnel into an ex-beaver lodge on a lake.
Okay.
And he built a school where you could slide in from the top.
Okay.
Is it done?
I don't remember that. But Amory Lovins, he's like crazy about, he's the one who started the Rocky Mountain Institute. And his house is like, he built a future house. You know, he grows tropical fruits in it, you know, using sunlight. This is part of its greenhouse, part of it's that. And he used to run the institute out of his house. Now they have a building.
Hmm.
So I don't remember the Beaver Lodge guy. That must have stuck in your mind.
It did.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah.
So,
you were going to say something. You were going to rain on my parade?
No, not really, because I think it's great. But I do think there's things people can do, but you kind of got there. And that is, it's as important as picking up the rubbish in the street that you campaign and demand a future for your kids that is better. And I think if we could show people this is a future that we could have, we could have it now. We should demand it. We should fight for it. And I think hope is better than anxiety. Hope for a better future works better than fear of a bad one.
Yesterday, I got onto this site to calculate my personal footprint. Is that mankind basically has an allotment. Nature has an allotment. They can absorb a certain amount of carbon dioxide and shit from us that it can process in a year.
Yeah.
And what this website does is it calculates by which date of the year we've used up our allotment. And this year it's going to be August 22nd. We will have used up our year's worth of shit that we can give to nature. And we've been doing this every year. So everything that happens after August 22nd is making things worse, and we have to take it back in the future in order to get back to normal.
We're doing a lot of dumb things, though.
A lot of dumb things. And then it has a way. You want to know your personal, footprint? And I went and checked, and basically, you know, I calculate I'm flying about 150 hours a year. I'm out of my allotment in January.
So the answer is not that we should do less flying, but we should make flying less damaging.
Well, there's that. And we should, for every mile flown, we should grow trees to absorb that carbon dioxide.
Right. But frankly, having aircraft flying with hydrogen fuel is a realizable and a sensible way to go, because it does two things. It's bulky. So the planes would need to be bigger, but they wouldn't be heavier. They'd have more volume, but they wouldn't be heavier if they had hydrogen fuel. But the sort of
I don't know.
The accidents aircraft have very often are on takeoff and landing, and what kills people is fire. If they were using hydrogen fuel, there would be far fewer deaths from fire because there's virtually no radiant heat.
Yeah, no, I know all that. And we do demonstrate this all the time. So that's, and by the way, once hydrogen is released, it goes up because it's the lightest element. It doesn't hang around. It goes up at 22 miles per hour or something like that. It immediately goes up and floats to the top of the atmosphere and then dissipates into space. So hydrogen, it just doesn't stay around. So you can't, it's not like a fire. The only way that it's a fire, as you describe, is that if you squeeze it through a small hole and you've managed to ignite it somehow, and then you have a fire, which is like, but if you just punch a hole in a container and the hydrogen's rushing out and you try to set that hydrogen on fire, there's no way you can do that. The hydrogen is moving too fast. It doesn't ignite.
So what are we saying? You're agreeing with me. We should have hydrogen fuel in aircraft.
Yeah. But people, you know, you see all these airplanes crash, and yet people like you and me still get on them. So the fear of crashing or burning or something like that is so small that we don't even pay attention to it. It's the same thing with a gasoline car. I mean, this boom that happens is because the fumes go underneath the car, find a spark, and then the whole thing goes up. That doesn't happen with hydrogen.
No. So hydrogen fueled cars, hydrogen fueled aircraft, that's got to be the way.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But okay, so maybe that's... Yeah, so here's the deal. If 100,000 people all say, I want to move to hydrogen aircraft, or if we manage to get 100 venture capitalists to invest in hydrogen aircraft, you know, instead of what if oil money went to figuring those things out, then they would be figured out.
Well, but you and I know somebody who has an airline. We should sit on him and say,
it's not that
simple. Ask for better.
It's not that simple because he's like, yeah. And I, by the way, I was supposed to go to his island next week.
Right.
With this group called Ultramarine. And I didn't go. And it was because to stay at Richard Branson's island in one of his fucking bungalows for 5 days cost $30,000.
Wow. So, he's got it nailed.
I'd love to meet Branson, but I'm sorry. I'll get a couple of minutes with him during my 5 days. It's just not worth $30,000. I'm starting a new organization. I mean, $35,000? Right.
Well, I'm sure he gets it filled up, though.
there are people out there. And so, yeah, theoretically, I'm hanging out with the powers that be kind of people that, you know, have enough extra money lying around to. But still, $30,000.
Well,
I'm sorry. I've got a better use for that money. That was just a little bit. Last year, actually 2 years ago, I went, or last year, forget. I went and they had a sponsor. So they put up the majority of the money, so it wasn't so ridiculous. It was like 10K or something like that. And 10K is still a lot of money, but I can do 10K. But 30K, sorry, that's a... and you know, you remember we went through this thing with the artist, the Huku Iku guys, who were going to help us find other artists, and they're going to charge me, I don't know, fucking $100,000 to get you connected to younger artists and have art that is half you and half them.
I didn't really buy into that.
Okay. All right. It was the Carlos Santana who came out of came back from the dead and did an album that was a platinum because he teamed up with a bunch of young artists.
Yeah.
Whether who that ever the hell they were. And so he brought in all these new young people into his music, Carlos Santana. Anyway, and that's kind of what I was thinking to do with you. The reason I know him is because he was on the island. His name is Matt, some Polish unpronounceable name. and I
remember you talking about it, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And so he was there. That's how I know him. And I just had a Zoom with him yesterday. I told him, sorry, I can't. Again, it was like ridiculous amount of money. And so he wants to do something else. He's doing a virtual meditation platform. He wants everybody to go into his platform and meditate for 15 minutes every day. And he needs $1.5 million. He's not asking me for money. Facebook is already donating like $500,000 for his concept because it's something that they can do with their VR headset, which is nobody's going to use because nobody wants to put a fucking headset on. It's just dirty. Anyway, I have one. It's still, I never used it. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I had some very smart people come and say they wanted to license some of my imagery for an Oculus Rift project. And I said, yeah, and I was quite excited about it. But they turned up at the barn with an enormous amount of equipment. This was before anyone had heard of Oculus Rift. So to be fair, it was all prototype stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And it took hours, literally hours. I don't mean just long minutes. It took literally hours to set up. And I thought, this is a dead end. No one's going to touch this. This is ridiculous. But it was so brilliant when I tried it. Uh-huh. I was totally sold.
All right.
Even with about a 3-hour lead time.
Hey, I should talk to you about I'm designing a moon base.
You take risk with your life, Hank.
So there are three phases to moon base construction. Phase one is the way we did the International Space Station. In other words, we make capsules and we send them over, plop them on the moon and connect them together like the ISS. And that becomes the first moon base. And it's big enough for a couple of people to do small stuff because there are small rooms. I mean, it's like staying in the ISS.
It's it's 17 foot across, right?
Yeah. Yeah. If that's right. Something like that. Anyway, so that's phase one. Phase two is where we send parts to the moon and we have robots build structures. That's phase two. And so these structures are still all going to be made out of parts made on Earth, and they're just going to be put together like Lego on the moon. And phase three is where we have reached the ability that we can actually do a little bit of industrial stuff on the moon. In other words, we can make stuff out of the ISRU. And phase three is Roger Dean underground structures. That's phase three. When I was first thinking about this during our conference, I was all about phase two. We got to do phase three. We got to get there. We should start start with phase three. Why are we wasting time with one and two? And the answer is that it's a big leap to having that ability.
Because it's a big leap, you have to be planning it now. The other two, the small leap.
So Jim Caravalla is actually making big progress on his mining robots. He's up to 50 people now, and he's mining platinum in South Africa with his robots.
Hank, all that technology will work. What you need is to inspire people with actually getting on the ground and prototyping.
No, I understand that. I understand that. I get that. So but the prototype that I wanted, so here's the other side of that coin. The other side of that coin is that SpaceX has told me that they can land me 150 tons on the moon by 2024.
That's okay. Pretty soon.
I'm going to give them an extra year, and I'm going to say it's not 150 tons, it's only 100 tons. It's fine. 100 tons on the moon. And so what the hell are you going to send up 100 tons? What are you going to send up there that's 100 tons? That's my question. And is anybody, I mean, like the things that you see that people want to send up there are little rovers. They're like satellites, no way. They're getting smaller. So, I mean, what is it? What's that tonnage? What do you need? What's the Starship for?
I would say you need, even at the very beginning, you need to be able to convert whatever's on the moon into usable, like something that can make oxygen out of what's there. There's a lot of oxygen there. It's in the rocks and it's also in the ice.
Right. Right. But I mean, getting to the ice and getting to the rock material requires some infrastructure.
Yes.
And that's what I'm talking about.
Yes.
So hear me out. So I've been thinking, so what is the phase two structure? What does it look like? What's the most efficient way to encapsulate space by putting parts together? And, you know, of course, a sphere would be the perfect shape object. But, you know, the bottom, yeah. Anyway, I believe it's a dome. If you're going to build something above ground, it's a dome. And so I've been thinking about how to build a dome on the moon. And the answer is, well, the way we build domes here, I'm spending time with the number one dome maker at Burning Man. He built 35 domes at Burning Man last burn. And he also built a 110-foot pyramid, you know, at Burning Man. Ridiculous, huge structures. He manufactures his stuff in China. He's got a shop in a place where the people that he's working with built a 39-story building in 19 days using that new fast manufacturing technology. They're going to manufacture. If they decide to build a moon base, by the time we get our first moon base, they'll be on moon base number 10. And figuring out how to build something is about iterating. You got to build it and see what works and what doesn't work. You can't just sit in a room and try to think of everything. I just don't believe that. So
that's why you need to be prototyping ASAP.
Yeah. So the prototype that I want to build, there's two things I want to accomplish with my prototype. One is I want to get the technology to actually build it using something that's like a robot. So I need a device that can, and here's how domes normally get built. Normally domes get built, you build a frame and then you put triangles onto the frame. That's how they normally get built. And I'm saying that is a two-step process. I want it to be a one-step process. I just want triangles to be locked together. I want you to put the triangle in place with something like a crane, and then I want maybe something from the inside that's gonna bolt them together. So I want a dome that's made out of triangles that are all locked together that are prefabbed. And then I don't want there to be any windows. And what I want to try and see is how long can people stand to be in that object without having psychological problems?
You've already got a dome.
I've already got a dome, but it's translucent so that they get daytime and nighttime automatically, which is fake. If you're underground or if you're buried under a couple of meters of regolith, you're not going to have that daytime, nighttime. And if you're on the moon, daytime is 14 days and nighttime is 14 nights.
Yeah.
So you
underground is still better.
Yeah, underground, exactly. So what I'm doing is I'm trying to understand what happens underground.
But Hank, if you're building something to do the tests in, it would be nothing like what you would finally do, because psychologically it's the wrong approach anyway. What do you learn?
So what I'm going to learn is what is the minimum building block of domes that we need to see on the moon.
Yeah, but your focus is on the how to build something, not on, you should be on what you build, not how to build it. Once you figure out what to build, then you can figure out how to build it.
The world is full of fucking architects who have these fanciful ideas about what to build, and they're all very nice, but they're all impractical.
Well, I'd say differently. The world has virtually no architects that have truly visionary ideas, and those that they're all simple to build, but really not worth building.
So the thing that I'm thinking to build is a pressurized 40-foot dome, and I'm going to project in this dome, project like the holodeck. You know what the holodeck is? Yeah, like a holodeck, so that you project, so like you're, so that it actually looks like you're outside someplace. And I want to see whether people can actually function under those conditions. I want to know, because, you know, they say, we need a window. Everybody said, no, we have to have a window. You want to know what's going on outside. And if you're on the moon and you look out the window, nothing is ever going to change.
Doesn't matter.
It's going to be this white, desolate thing that...
You know, people like going out in the desert, lying on their back and staring at the stars. And that will be visible from the moon.
Yes. The problem is radiation.
Sure. So you've got to deal with radiation. Radiation, by the way, is very directional. If you're not, if the sun isn't visible, radiation is much less of a problem.
Well, you still have cosmic radiation.
Sure.
So nobody's building a structure with, I mean, like, nobody's saying that you can't go outside if you want to have a look. And I think we're going to make that easier and easier. But we do know that you can't stay outside for too long, because it's just like stepping into a nuclear reactor every once in a while. There's only so much of that you can do before you can't do it anymore. That's the, you got a little badge saying how much radiation you've absorbed. And if you reach your limit, you can't go back in or back out. So anyway, I want to know, and you know, if you're building underground, you're not going to have windows to the outside world. What are you talking about?
You have windows into an atrium like a modern hotel.
That's still not outside. That's inside.
No, that is. But you would also, you could also have a tower where you have windows to the outside. Why couldn't you? Why wouldn't you? It's just obvious.
Yeah, you could. You could.
We shouldn't be doing this while I'm recording, because I want to tell you, this sounds terribly pedestrian.
Yeah. No, but you can tell me. But I'm doing it anyway. I mean, I've got to present something. I've got to present something. And you know, what I'm planning to do is to build a kit of triangles that stick together at the side, so that kids can build these things, and then have a kids robotic competition to see who can build a robot, can build one of these things the quickest.
I don't know what to say. I mean, you're going to take us back to 1945 in terms of what technology is doing. Maybe a little bit more efficient, but the experience.
By the way, if we can build a dome, we can build any shape as long as it's not square with the same technology.
I know that.
So we can build your atrium on the surface by, you know, it's just a question of how long of an arm do you have, or do you have a thing that actually crawls up the side of an existing structure and adds another triangle? I mean, how do you build that? That is the trick. Because, you know, I believe that once we have a way of building the triangles, the way we have manufacturing capability, you know, right now, I think my dome has got 5 different triangles, and that makes it, you know, so we have to have production for 5 different triangles. But in reality, we could build an egg-shaped dome or build an amoeba-shaped dome made out of triangles. The computer can handle all the triangles and making all the parts so that every triangle can be unique.
It does sound to me, from a technological point of view, old technology, old history, solving problems that, you know, we've moved beyond.
So how would you do it?
How would I do what?
Build a dome? How would you build something on the surface of the moon?
Well, we looked at this quite a lot in the conference. And, you know, inevitably the first things that are going to be on the moon are going to be fancy tin cans.
Yes. What's next?
What's next, I think, is definitely you need to plan to go underground.
Right, but to go underground, it's, you know, like connecting above ground and underground and solving underground. We don't even know what's underground. We have to explore underground. We've only gone like a couple of inches down below the surface of the moon.
So I would imagine that's something we would do. But you can go underground without going underground. You can find a hollow or a chasm or something.
Yeah. So now we're back to the lava tube story.
Not really. It could be a simple meteorite.
What do you mean?
It could be a meteorite crater that we roof
they're
over.
All above ground. They're all above ground. You can go to Arizona and examine the meteor crater and find out. They couldn't even find the metal that was in that that asteroid that hit that spot. Everything is vaporized. Yes, and we are talking about building on the rim of Shackleton, and the rim of Shackleton, I think Shackleton is like 20 miles across.
No, my point was that if you've got something like that, you can see what's underground because it's made a hole.
It's made a hole, but it's completely transformed what's in that hole from what it's crystallized all the shit out of what's at the bottom of the hole. And right now, the places that we're planning to go, all those holes are filled with ice. Mm. That's where we get the ice.
Well, there you go. So that does solve that problem, doesn't it?
It doesn't solve that problem because you're talking about sending a robot down to absolute zero to retrieve some ice. How many robots can operate at absolute zero or 5 degrees Kelvin or whatever it is down there? This is the coldest place in the solar system. So we need to figure out how to build something that can retrieve, you know, stuff from the coldest place in the solar system. This is not trivial. It's not like lying around or something like that.
Hmm.
It's going to be a bitch to get at that stuff. So it's not like it's readily available. And for the first, the ISS survives with I don't know, 6 people, whatever it is, without having to suck anything from anywhere. It just, we resupply it. And that's the way I've been doing that for 40 years. If you've got that kind of capability on the moon, for the foreseeable future, we'll be sending that stuff from Earth. It'll be easier to send it from Earth than to retrieve it on the moon. And we will recycle all the water and recycle all the air. And it's 9:21. What time is my next? I just want to make sure that I'm not running over. No, I'm fine. I'm fine.
We always have arguments about the moon project.
Yes, we always will, and that's good. That's good. I'm a big fan. I was the biggest proponent of going underground until I listened to NASA guys explaining the phase one, phase two, phase three. This is Rob Mueller. I think he might have been there. I don't know.
Yeah, he was there.
Yeah, so Rob Mueller he's in charge of Swamp Works at NASA. And so he does all of the crazy ass projects to figure out technologies. And Swamp Works is the one that gave the job to Pisces to sinter the material, which is, by the way, the material we need to go under to build underground.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're working on that. I think that the ultimate device for sintering is, you know how they make how they made the first artificial diamond?
No idea.
Boules. A boule. It comes in a tube. And what it is you have a hydrogen flame because you need to be able to get to the high temperature. And you've got this thing and you drop carbon onto it that takes it up to whatever the formation temperature of diamond is. And basically it melts that carbon onto what is called a boule. It's a rod that you lower through the flame and powder keeps on getting added. And they make all kinds of different crystals out of using that process now.
Right.
So what I'm saying is we should heat using laser or whatever, wherever we want something to be deposited, and then bombard it with particles of the dust that need to be sintered. Because my theory is you should be able to get the temperature of that surface to be exactly the temperature we need for sintering, and then throw things at it, like an inkjet printer, throw things at it. You know how an inkjet printer works?
Yeah.
It magnetizes the paper and the droplets of ink get sucked onto it.
I didn't know that. Okay.
That's how an inkjet printer works. So basically I'm thinking that laser and then bombard it with the particles that you want to make the surface out of. They're still trying to figure out how to make a landing pad. And I think that's gotta be the same thing. You gotta have robots that are doing that. The problem with it is it takes a fucking lot of energy to do all of that. And right. everything that's on the drawing board is like minuscule amounts of energy. We need massive amounts of energy.
And is that a difficult issue on the moon? I mean, you've got...
It's not a difficult issue
on the moon. Solar radiation in unbelievable quantities.
Yeah, but setting up enough solar panels to actually be able to do stuff like that is going to be a bitch. And if you take off and land, basically the ejecta from your rocket is just going to go and it's going to destroy anything anywhere. Because these things go ballistic. The dust goes ballistic. There's nothing to stop it. So.
And the dust is lethal because it's sharp.
It's sharp. Well, and it's probably not going to do much help to your solar panels. So I did design something that was retractable into a structure, but I mean, this is all stuff when we're actually building large structures on the moon. I just don't think it's for phase one or two, something like that. I think the answer is that we need to have a fission reactor, like something that powers a nuclear submarine. So the problem is not on the moon, the problem is on Earth. Getting that thing off planet requires us to do something which everybody's agreed that we would never do, send nukes into space. So that is the problem. One nuclear device would do it. You could power a moon base and do all this sintering and all this stuff. One nuclear device could, I mean, one nuclear device moves a goddamn submarine. So the nuclear device that powers the the USS Ronald Reagan, which is an aircraft carrier, basically takes care of that, all the power needs of that aircraft carrier for 25 years. So it's got a 50-year lifespan, and it needs to refuel once in its lifetime.
Wow.
And so we've worked it out. I mean, the military has this shit. So we if we wanted one, we could get one. And so this is why I think that having the Space Force on the moon is useful, because the Space Force is going to demand like massive amounts of energy for whatever they do, and they're going to get their way. You know what I'm saying? For all the wrong reasons, but I'm going to get a nuclear device on the moon. I said, I'll build you a landing platform if you give me a nuke. And I think that'll be a deal for the Space Force. And they need to be underground, by the way. They can't be at the surface. Just FYI.
We need to do the prototype. All of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so on the International Moon Base Alliance, which I have three people on the board, the three people are Bernard Foing. Bernard is the European Space Agency guy. So he gets me connected to everything that's going on in Europe. The next one is Taisik Lee. Taisik Lee is Korean. He's like the head of engineering in Korea. Korea doesn't have a space agency, but he does everything that would be happening if there was a space agency.
Wasn't he at the conference?
Yeah, he was.
Yeah, I remember him.
Taisik Lee just completed a vacuum chamber, a dirty vacuum chamber. It's 6 meters in diameter, 4 meters deep, and it creates a vacuum that you can have dust in. All the other vacuum chambers are dustless, and they've figured out how to make one with dust. So if you're going to test equipment on the moon, you're going to have to deal with moon dust.
Yeah.
So he's got that capability. And then the other one is Jim Caravalla, who is building the robots to go underground. We need to go to the next step, but I think the next step that's for me that's reasonable is to build a dome at my ranch, and basically I just want to test to see whether 40 feet is a space in which you can do anything. You know, what's the size of the dome that we're going to build on the moon? What's the size of the enclosure? And so I have to build a device which can actually reach the top of the dome or crawl up the dome, whatever. I mean, but reach the top of the dome is something. And so how big is the crane? How much does that thing weigh? What's the technology necessary to do that, to build something above ground? By the way, the Chinese have discovered a new way to make a floor in a skyscraper. It's two layers of stainless steel with tubes of stainless steel between them. They're just like a tube about, I don't know, like this. You can't see it. Yeah, so they're tubes and sandwiched between. It's like looking at a mattress with the springs, but the springs are pipes.
Yeah.
And they're welded together. This has turned out to be incredibly strong. They tried different things, and they've never found anything that's as strong. And they, you know, so they can just take this stuff and manufacture it in large quantities and cut it in shapes and then have instant floor. I think that we can bolt triangles or whatever together and make a floor and then bolt a dome to it with triangles. That's sort of my methodology at this point.
This is not stainless steel and it's not tubes, but it's incredibly light and incredibly strong.
Yeah.
We broke a piece, but it's just cardboard. But the principle is understood. I mean, it's basically a honeycomb you're talking about. It has a kind of...
This is stronger than a honeycomb.
Sorry?
This is stronger than honeycomb. They're tubes, so they're equally strong in every direction. You could think that a honeycomb has, you know, you could draw a line through a honeycomb where there are flat bits that are... But the pipe, this is a discovery. I mean, they try different things because they have this manufacturing capability to manufacture shit very quickly. And so this is all robotically made. I mean, to weld the pipe to the between the plates requires some manual dexterity.
Right. Yes. And this stuff is,
right? It's, I don't think it's a human can do that. You can't reach into the middle of the floor and do that weld. So they figured out the manufacturing of this and are able to produce it in quantity. That's how they build buildings faster now.
You're not thinking of doing this on the shipping out floors on the moon?
Well, I need a material that's super strong. So it's probably not going to be, you know, stainless steel. It's probably going to be aluminum or magnesium or something like that. My understanding from talking to people is that magnesium is stronger than steel and lighter than aluminum. Payload is everything. How much can we fit in that damn rocket? The bay is actually very big. I was doing the calculation. It's 10 times bigger than the bay of the space shuttle.
Okay.
So there is, so space is not the issue. Weight is the issue. So I imagine that we're going to have to send up a bunch of robots that do things.
There is, by the way, quite a lot of aluminium in the rocks on the moon.
Yeah, but again, this is like we need Iceland to freaking make the aluminum out of it. You know, it takes a tremendous amount of energy to get the aluminum out. And eventually I can understand that we will have, you know, low energy nuclear LNR, low energy nuclear reaction, I guess. And it's cold fusion. There are people saying that they're getting close. I said,
remember
okay.
That when I was a student.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I think that might come back and save us at some point. Not in the near future. So we'll have to rely on fission for now. But cold fusion is coming.
We should do this again and talk about old projects as well.
Yeah. So here's my the end game. If I can get a technique where I have a robot that can put triangles together, and we can prefab the triangles to be any shape, we can build a Roger Dean structure at Burning Man. It's the place to showcase. It's got to be a temporary structure. You got to be able to take it down. You can't like use shotcrete or something like that. No, you have to bolt it together and unbolt it.
Yeah, of course. I mean, we did build a portable version of it, as you know. It's on the back of a truck.
Yeah. So that doesn't. What I really want to demonstrate is the ability, the technical ability, to build something like that. Because Elon Musk is going to go to Burning Man.
The problem is, Hank, you're talking about you know, the old technology is building things out of little bits like bricks.
Yeah.
Or slightly bigger bits and slightly bigger bits. But that's still old technology. You know, we can grow it or do it or mold it. That's a much better way to do it. And even temporary structures, it's still a much better way.
So what do you do with it at the end of life, at the end of the burn?
Depends what you make it in, Hank.
Yeah.
Well, you could make it in something that's like an egg container, kind of prefabricated paper, but thick. So it is quite robust.
So prefabricated. So in order to truck it to Burning Man,
yeah,
it would have to be smaller than a 747 because they pre-built structure.
It could fit into a container.
Container is only 8 feet across.
Yeah, exactly. It can fit in a container and be assembled quickly. It would be assembled.
When you say assemble, what are you talking about?
Take it out of the container and put the bits together. Take about an hour.
Put the bits together is what I'm talking about. And you're just saying
you're talking about small bits. I'm talking about big bits, room-sized bits.
Yeah, I'm talking about room-sized bits. The triangles are going to be like 8 foot tall.
Let me show you something.
All right.
Now, I got to figure out where I've got something I can show you because I have.
I think we need to save this.
Let's do this one again because I've got drawings about how to do them.
I can smell my breakfast. I'm on the second floor.
Good luck with that.
And I've got a woman who thinks she's not beautiful, but she is downstairs making me wonderful food.
There you go. Beautiful and a great cook. What more could you ask? How do you finish this?
Check this out. I don't know if I showed you this, but let me see. Video settings. Touch up. Okay. So this is a slider in Zoom. Look at my wrinkle. Oh. Now you see it, now you don't. That's one thing. See where it says stop video on your thing?
Yeah.
Okay, the little thing right next to it, click on that.
It's recording now.
No, it's nothing to do with that. Click on that little...
Oh, share screen.
It's got all these different things on it. One of them is video settings.
No.
Go to the little arrow next to the stop video, next to the video, and click on that little arrow, and a menu comes up.
Yeah, it says share.
No. Where are you? There's mute and there's stop video, and there's video, right?
No, I've got recording, stop, pause, share screen, chat, participant, security, stop video, mute.
Okay. So look at the video, the one that has video, stop video. There's a little carrot, an up arrow next to it.
Yep.
Click on that.
It says stop video.
Click on it.
Okay. Choose virtual background.
There you go. Now the bottom, this has virtual settings.
Video settings.
Click on that.
Have I lost you?
No, I'm still here.
Okay.
Have you clicked on that? Did you get a full screen of other stuff?
Yeah, I've got, I don't know. I've got a menu and I've got my video.
Yes, fine touch up my appearance.
I see it, yes.
Okay, so turn that sucker on and slide it.
Ha, 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 ha,
So there you go. That's my present to you for today.
I assume you think I need it. All right.
No, I'm just saying, you can play with it. You can like not use it or use it, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's another thing that I actually did. So, and I've turned it off, by the way. I've turned off Touch Up My Experience. Okay, and I did 5 little tiny injections of Botox. And what Botox does is it basically disables these muscles from contracting.
Right.
So I can't frown anymore. I can't fucking frown anymore. It's like, this is me trying to frown. And there's still a little bit of a crack here. And so I probably should get a couple of more shots, but I will not have any wrinkles here at all. And that is Botox. And it's kind of a little scary because, you know, I like the frown. I like my grandchildren know when I'm frowning if they're not finishing their food. But now I won't be able to frown anymore. I'll just have to do it in a difficult way, a different way. Your dog will not recognize when you don't want him to do something.
No, they won't. No. They can read faces.
There you go. Yeah, exactly. It's like, I mean, I feel like an alien with my forehead like completely disabled. It wears off. And then you have to do it every 6 months or so. It's a...
Why? What's wrong with frowning?
Well, I'm just saying people are doing this. I'm learning about it. I did it for shits and grins to find out what it's like. It's weird. I can't frown anymore for the next whatever.
All right. Hank, thank you so much for coming on.
All right. So I'll be on the slopes from Monday to Monday. So it'll be in 2 weeks, something like that.
I'll send you a copy.
Yep.
And Freya and I will do an introduction, and then we'll talk about doing something, I don't know, about Tetris maybe.
There you go, whatever. We got it.
Thanks for joining.
Right. Take care. Bye.
Bye.